compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Muy buenos dias. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. Thank you for listening. My number is 888-914-9149. As ever, you can call me right now. Early in the show, you'll have the greatest success when it comes to getting in without a busy signal. So this would be a great time, 888-914-9149. I have good news for you. If you have medical bills that have piled up and maybe gone to collections because of COVID, check this out. This is from the New York Times. This affects a lot of people. Credit companies are going to remove stains from repaid medical debts. Now, this will affect different people in different ways, but here's the upshot of the whole thing. And let me just, I want to start at the section that's the most pertinent here. So they say debts that are paid off after they go to collections will be removed from your credit report instead of staying on your credit report for up to 7 years. This is according to Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. They've announced that they each keep files on roughly 200 million Americans, and they said that they are soon going to expunge those credit stains that may have been created through no fault of your own, just because of the way the last couple of years have been, for certain kinds of medical debts. So the changes, which will include removing black marks from your record if you've settled a debt after it went to collections. If you were, they said that they heard, I guess, from so many people about this problem that it caused them to really look into it and see what they could do. They said that there's a growing acceptance that these kinds of debts are not a good predictor of a consumer's financial behavior. The company said that the changes would eliminate up to 70% of the medical debt accounts on your credit report, assuming you have any of these, but a lot of people do, which contain reams of data that's used to calculate the all-important three-digit credit score that's the key to you getting a mortgage or a car loan or rental agreements, etc. So starting on July the 1st, medical debts that were paid off after they went to collections will no longer appear on your credit report. And those that do, if you already have some on there, they can last up to 7 years. New unpaid medical debts will now only appear after a full year of being sent to collections instead of the current 6 months. That will give you more time to address the debt with your insurance company or healthcare provider. And beginning in the first half of 2023, the credit reporting company said that they are going to exclude entirely unpaid medical collection debts under $500. The company's chief executive said in a joint statement, "As an industry, we remain committed to helping drive fair and affordable access to credit for all consumers." This is a good move, if you ask me. It's a great move for the consumer. The changes mirror some already in action elsewhere. The formulas used to generate credit scores have already been updated to reduce the influence of unpaid medical debts, or I should say paid medical debts. Unpaid medical debts, different story. These are medical debts that if you've settled them, you paid them, but it's after they went to collections. Those are the ones that are being affected here. The three companies' changes do go a bit further. For example, they will expunge more unpaid medical debts while reducing the negative information flowing into the calculations of lenders that haven't adopted the latest formulas. Chi-Chi Wu, a staff attorney at the National Consumer Law Center, says this is huge, no doubt about it. And it helps those who have medical debt due to things like co-pays and deductibles, which are usually under $500. The changes will do little to lift the scores of people with the largest unpaid debts, who are often dealing with catastrophic or costly illnesses that result in high bills, even with insurance coverage. "It is the sickest and the poorest, the most vulnerable, who are the 30%, said Ms. Wu, referring to the portion of unpaid medical debt accounts that will remain on credit reports. FICO, the most widely used credit score, baked in changes to ignore paid debts and to weigh certain unpaid medical collections less heavily starting in 2014 with its FICO 9 formula." And there's some more stuff about that. It says it also found that people with unpaid medical collections were less risky than those with other types of unpaid collections, so it factored in that information as well. But people with any unpaid accounts, including medical, are still riskier than those with none at all. So it didn't go as far as eliminating medical debt altogether, but it's taken a big step in that direction. And if you want to read the whole thing, you can read it by going to the show page, which is relevantradio.com/Patrick. There's more to it. There's more info there. And since you are a credit consumer, just like I am, and just like Cyrus is, we all are, and you have a credit score, just like we all do, this may be something that can really work to your advantage. Who knows? Maybe you're looking to buy a house or buy a car or something like that. This can make the difference between a terrible rate and a good rate. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, you welcome that kind of news. I think everybody would welcome that kind of news.
I think it's great news. Yeah, I think it's but it also shines a light on how many people are hurting and suffering, and then they get these medical bills that are enormous. They're like house payments. It's insane. It's the whole system's out of control. All right, don't get me started.
Well, it sounds like they're getting it back into control. It
That's
sounds
a
like
good
you know
step.
With a step like this.
Right. That is
yeah,
a really
and I
good
suspect
there
will be more coming as they fine tune this. It seems like it's taken a long time to get here. But that's a good thing if you ask me. I have, and I don't want to say too much just for the benefit of their privacy, but one of my grown sons, he had their first child was 3 months premature. And it wasn't all that long ago that a baby that was born that premature wouldn't survive, just impossible. But for some time now, we've had the state of the art of medicine that's capable of taking care of and saving the lives of little babies that are born that early. This kid's a tank now. So the happy ending is he survived. He did well. He throve, and he's doing really well. But they had, after their medical insurance and everything, and they showed us one time, Nancy and me, we were over for dinner, and they showed us like this stack of receipts from the hospitals and such. They said that it was over $1 million for their little son to be in the NICU. I didn't even know what a NICU was until that incident. You know, they said he's going to be down at the NICU. What's a NICU? Well, that's the neonatal center for premature babies, and they have all the means to keep them alive there. So he lived in the NICU for 3 months before he could come home, and they had a stack of bills. Over $1 million. Now, thankfully, an extremely small portion of that was on their shoulders. The vast majority of it was paid for. And by vast majority, what I mean is like $989,000 was paid for by insurance. They still had a burden to pay for, but it was amazing just how expensive that health care was for a little baby.
And you say a small amount. I mean, that small amount could be any like $5,000, $10,000. And that small amount could
is not small for the average
bankrupt.
Person.
It could completely ruin someone's life.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy stuff.
Well, I thought you'd like that story.
Yeah, that's good. That's good news.
Anytime we can make things easier for the consumer in a just way, I think that's a good thing. 888-914-9149. Let's get to some phone calls. We'll start with Terry in Chicago. Terry, you are first in line. Welcome.
Good morning, Patrick. I've got a quick question for you. Towards the end of Mass, they had an announcement yesterday in my parish here in Chicago. Evidently, this is citywide in our archdiocese, and we were informed that there was going to be a meeting next week for the parish members in regards to women becoming deacons. And I guess they want us to express our opinions, and that our opinions will be then given to the bishop, and then the bishop will go ahead and take our opinions to the synod that's apparently coming up. And
right.
And I'm just a little bit confused by it, and I'm not really sure, exactly what the traditional teachings are on this. But I figured I'd give you a call and ask you.
Well, I'm happy to assist if I can. The first thing to keep in mind is that, well, there's several things to keep in mind, it seems to me. One is that the diaconate is the beginning or the first step, the lowest level, if you want to put it that way, of the sacrament of holy orders. So it's the beginning of what, for some men, winds up becoming ordination to the priesthood when they receive that second level of holy orders, and for a much fewer number, the fullness of holy orders by being consecrated as a bishop. But it's all holy orders. It's all the same sacrament is the key to remember here. Now, the problem is, if you ask me, is that the church has already said there can be no females admitted to holy orders. And this is most recently said by Pope John Paul II. He wrote a document called Ordinatio Sacerdotalis. It's an apostolic constitution. He came out with this back in 1994. And he outlines the reasons why Jesus chose men for the office of apostle. He shows from scripture and the history of the church specifically that this is not something that the church has any authority or power to do. So, quoting Pope Paul VI, Pope Paul VI says this, and Pope John Paul II quotes him on this in this document. It's called Ordinatio Sacerdotalis. That means on priestly ordination. He says, regarding the position of the Catholic Church, she holds that it is not admissible to ordain women to the priesthood for very fundamental reasons. These include the example recorded in sacred scripture of Christ choosing his apostles only from men, the constant practice of the church, which has imitated Christ in choosing only men, and her living teaching authority, which has consistently held that the exclusion of women from the priesthood is in accordance with God's plan for his church. Now, Pope John Paul II elaborates on this theme, and he adds a few others of his own that were not contained in what Pope Paul VI said. But it's important to note that the polemic goes something along these lines. Well, there were deacons in the early church. I mean, we have evidence of it. There are women who are called deacons in Scripture, and we have historical evidence of women who served as deaconesses, and that's the more proper term, deaconess. Therefore, if it was available in the early church, what do you mean we can't have deaconesses now? Why couldn't we have deaconesses now? And so there has been kind of an agitation that's been going on for decades now among certain folk who are proactively agitating for the church to, quote-unquote, change this teaching and allow for deacons. The thing to remember is, and some really good historical scholarship on this topic is contained in books such as Deaconesses in the Early Church. That's a book published by Ignatius Press, and it's a scholarly account taking into account all of the historical data about deaconesses. Who were these women, and what was their function, and how did they become deaconesses, and what was that understood to mean, let's say, by way of contrast with the man who was ordained as a deacon? Were they actually ordained? You know, was there laying on of hands by a bishop who ordained them to the diaconate? And the answer to that is no. They were something akin to what we would think of as, say, religious sisters. One of the reasons, and I hope you don't mind me giving you a somewhat lengthy answer, but it's an important question that's often misunderstood. One of the reasons is that in the early church, it was not uncommon for baptismal catechumens to be baptized naked. And so if you have young women who are not necessarily young, but women in general, who are among those who are being baptized, it presents a problem. May I say to you, if you've got all these naked ladies to be baptized and you have men who are baptizing them. So among the reasons that deaconesses were present in the church would be to attend to those matters so that you didn't have a situation where there could be some, you know, falling out of the state of grace. Let's just put it that way. Now, that's not the only one, but that was one of the considerations that was present in the early church. And by the way, the argument that just because the early church did it, therefore we should do it, it doesn't always work out that way, and there would be a good example. I definitely don't want to go back to that custom in the early church, which wasn't universal, but it wasn't unheard of. So that's one issue to consider. These deaconesses in the early church, they were not ordained to the sacrament of holy orders. They were set apart and consecrated for a particular purpose, but it wasn't the sacrament of holy orders. Now, that book that I mentioned is just one example, but it goes through and it demonstrates this, I believe, conclusively. So back to Pope John Paul II now for a minute. He, in his document, Ordinatio Sacerdotalis, he says, after giving all the reasons why Jesus chose men and not women, he didn't even choose his mother. And his mother, Mary, is the greatest of all human persons, and he didn't choose her. He only chose men. And he also explodes this notion that, well, that was just the mores. Those were just the mores and the customs of the day. And of course, it was patriarchal and they wouldn't have allowed it. And he explodes that myth in short order, saying that Jesus was not subject to those mores and cultural slash religious dictates. And he violated them all the time for a higher purpose. You know, your apostles are picking wheat on the Sabbath. You're not allowed to pick wheat on the Sabbath. And Jesus talks about how he is the Lord of the Sabbath and how the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. So even though this deeply entrenched custom among the Jews at the time was practiced by everybody under punishment, pain of punishment, Jesus said, no, I'm going to break that rule because it's no longer an important rule. It's no longer a necessary rule. In fact, you guys are taking it way too far. So Jesus had a custom or a habit, let's say, of when necessary, when appropriate, he would break all sorts of patriarchal and customary rules. So Pope John Paul II says that argument doesn't work. And even though this document is not very long, it's very conclusive, if you ask me, because when you get right down to the very end of all of his explanation on this issue, he says in the very last couple paragraphs, he says, although the teaching that priestly ordination is to be reserved to men alone has been preserved by the constant and universal tradition of the Church and firmly taught by the Magisterium in its more recent documents, at the present time, in some places, it is nonetheless considered still open to debate. You could kind of picture him rolling his eyes as he wrote those words. In some places, it is nonetheless considered still open to debate. Or the Church's judgment that women are not to be admitted to ordination is considered to have been merely, or to have a merely disciplinary force. Now, here's the money quote. Here's the great part of this. He concludes by saying, wherefore, in order that all doubt may be removed regarding a matter of great importance, a matter which pertains to the Church's divine constitution itself, in virtue of my ministry of confirming the brethren, he's invoking Luke 22:32 there. He says, I declare that the Church has no authority whatsoever to confer priestly ordination on women, and that this judgment is to be definitively held by all the Church's faithful. Now, that was issued in May of 1994. Now, what you're likely to hear if you were to bring this document up is, well, he was talking about priestly ordination. And we're not talking about priestly ordination. We're talking here those who are, you know, as he put it, in some places, some people consider it still open to debate. You're likely to hear somebody say, well, that's dealing with priestly ordination. That's not dealing with the diaconate. The point is, priestly ordination is the second step or the second level, the higher level of the sacrament of holy orders. That's how you become a priest. Priestly ordination involves the sacrament of holy orders, as does the diaconate. So all those deacons out there, all those good deacons who are deaconing every weekend and throughout the week, and they are assisting at baptisms, or they're baptizing babies and witnessing weddings and the other things that the deacons do, they can do things by virtue of their ordination to the sacrament of holy orders that is proper to their state. They're not laymen, in other words. They have received the sacrament of holy orders. And the sacrament of holy orders at the next level is that of priesthood. I mean, it goes to the level of priesthood. So this is what's at stake here as far as the synodal process. And it seems to me, especially in Germany, where there's a great deal of effort underway to try to get women in the diaconate. And honestly, the real reason behind that is because they want women in the priesthood. That's the end game. That's the goal. And the diaconate is a kind of first step, a strategic first step to get to that. Because you know what will happen is, in a scenario in which the Church were to say, okay, we will now have women deacons, you know that once that takes place, and it's not going to take place, I want to make a prediction there, as Pope John Paul II said, it can't take place, it's impossible. But let's just say in an alternate universe that it did take place. Well, as soon as that happens, the clamor then will change from women in the diaconate to, well, if we can have women deacons, why can't we have women priests? Why can't we? I mean, if the women deacons are doing thus and so, and they already have the sacrament of holy orders, again, this is an alternate universe, not the universe in which we live. You know that the very next step is going to be to clamor for women in the priesthood. And my view of the whole thing is, having studied it for quite a few years now, is that that's the real goal. Women in the diaconate is not the real goal. Women in the priesthood is the real goal. And this is a means to achieve it. Now, I'm not saying, by saying all of this, I'm not in any way imputing anything negative to your local parish. I'm not imputing anything negative to your diocese or to the people who are involved in the synod. Not at all. But the fact is, in Germany right now, they are really strongly pushing for this, and that is being reflected in many areas. And so that's the thing to keep in mind. Also, one last thing. I've got to take a break. Maybe we can roll some music and get to our break. But we also have Pope Francis himself saying, no, no women deacons, not going to happen. So that's about what I can tell you at the moment, Terry. And if you're interested in that book, it's called Deaconesses in the Early Church, published by Ignatius Press. The name of the author is escaping me, but you can find it easily at your local Catholic bookstore. Thank you. I'll be right back. You have a special place in God's plan for the world. Learning about Christ's role in history can change your life and strengthen your faith. Right now, get free access to Christendom College's online history class at principalsclasses.com/Madrid.
It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Let them eat cake. Or let them listen to cake, right, Cyrus?
I like that.
Cake is good. Really good. Okay, this is a Catholic show, not a music show. But we do a little bit of both. 888-914-9149. How about Frank now in New York, New York? Good morning, Frank. Welcome.
Good morning. So my question is, the other day I was asked this question. If Catholics are forbidden from attending same-sex weddings, but when it comes to attending a wedding of a Catholic who is marrying outside the church, there seems to be some leeway in attending that wedding. Like, you know, some teachings basically say, as far as attending, again, a Catholic who is marrying outside the church, you know, mm-hmm. you can go perhaps if you voice your disapproval, but you go in order to keep the peace. You know, it seems to be a little, I don't know, leeway. But when it comes to same-sex marriage, you know, we're forbidden to go. Yeah. I mean, both seem to be wrong in attending, you know. And my question would be, too, would it be a sin to attend either one of those weddings?
Okay, well, this is a very important question, and the answer is kind of contained in the question. So, Frank, let me begin by saying I don't buy into the notion that I hear from some people that, you know, as long as you voice your opposition to this and tell them that they shouldn't be doing this, you can go celebrate it. I've never understood that logic, you know, or when people say that, well, you have to keep lines of communication open. And I'm all about that. Believe me, I like open communication. I don't want alienation or fractured relationships or pain in the family. I mean, I don't like any of that as much as the next guy doesn't like any of that. So that notwithstanding, though, what's the point? And I'm not asking you this question, Frank. I'm just saying rhetorically, maybe. What's the point of voicing your opposition to the bride and groom for maybe one or the other, or both perhaps are Catholic and they're getting married at the park or at the beach or in some other setting that's not fulfilling the church's requirement, what's called canonical form? That's a phrase in canon law. It just refers to that the church requires certain things to be in place for that wedding to be valid if you are a baptized Catholic. If both parties are baptized Catholics, or if one party is a baptized Catholic, the canonical form is required in order for the marriage to be valid. Or to say it a different way, if the couple, either one or both of whom are Catholic, marry in a way that's not according to the church's canonical form, which means you get married in a church and you have as the official witness a priest or a deacon, could be a bishop too for that matter. If you don't do that, you have an invalid marriage. So that's not the case for non-Catholics. So it's not the case with Protestants. If two Protestant folk want to get married at the beach, great. And you can go to that wedding and you can go to that reception and you can celebrate. Because Protestants, even though they're baptized, they're not obligated to observe the church's canonical form. Baptized Catholics are. Other baptized people who are not Catholic are not. Furthermore, non-baptized people, whatever they may be, if they are Buddhist, they could be Hindu, maybe no religion at all, maybe atheist, or any combination thereof, they too are not bound by any canonical form. They can get married at the justice of the peace, validly, etc. So the complicating factor is if one or both of the parties to the marriage is a baptized Catholic. So that's why it's never made sense to me that somebody would say, well, you can go ahead and go just to preserve family togetherness and keep the lines of communication open, but just be sure that you protest and tell them that they shouldn't be doing this, and then you go and celebrate it? That's the part that it's just a real disconnect there. Why would you go celebrate something that you know is invalid? And that's where the pain and anguish and heartache comes in for families, where somebody says, I can't go to that wedding if you don't get married in the church, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the church, by the way, could, for a little subtext here, Frank, the church easily, with a stroke of a pen, actually, change this law. If a future pope were to decide this is not helping, this is hurting, and I've read some canon law literature in which canon lawyers are advocating for a change to this law in the church so that it won't be this problem and we don't wind up with so many invalid marriages. So that could happen, and maybe it will happen. Maybe the pope, or under the authority of the pope, those who have the competency to revise the church's canon law would do so, and this will change. But in the meantime, you can't do it. So long answer here to a short question, but I'm spiraling into the final part of this answer, and that is, that's why personally I would not go to a wedding between a baptized Catholic or two baptized Catholics that's not following the canonical form, because you would thereby be celebrating, quote unquote, an invalid marriage, which is seriously sinful for them. And it would be a cause of scandal, because you are, by your presence there, you are saying to everybody, I think this is okay. I'm okay with it. I'm good with this. I can handle this. And I can come and celebrate and drink champagne and dance and eat wedding cake and all that because, you know, even though this is wrong, I'm going to be here to show that it's okay with me. And that kind of a mixed signal is never good. Now, I used this analogy a few weeks ago. I'll just mention it briefly. St. John the Baptist, of course, he was beheaded by King Herod because the woman that King Herod was living with as his wife, and he was publicly touting her as his wife. She was actually his brother's wife, so she was not his lawful wife. And St. John the Baptist was speaking out about that and saying, you're living in adultery. This is wrong. God will judge you. And so through her machinations with her daughter, she finagled King Herod into cutting off St. John the Baptist's head. So I can't picture, you know, King Herod going down into the dungeon where St. John the Baptist was in chains and trying to reason with him and say, look, I understand you don't recognize this as a valid marriage. I understand that. Okay. But could you just come to the reception, please? Can you just come have some cake? It'll be nice. You have some food. It'll be a lot better than this dungeon. And if you could just come to the reception, it would keep the lines of communication open with us, and you know, it would avoid a lot of unpleasantness. Can you picture St. John the Baptist saying yes to that? I personally cannot. In fact, I know he wouldn't say yes to it. He wouldn't go along to get along. So as painful and as difficult as it is, sometimes that's the choice one has to make. And I'm sharing with you my view on this topic. The church doesn't have a teaching to say, like at the level of doctrine, but I believe that everything the church does teach about the sanctity of marriage, etc., would militate in that direction. So with all of that having been said, that's basically my way of saying that I wouldn't go to either of those two weddings. I don't think there would be any coherence to say you can't go to a same-sex marriage, quote-unquote, but you can go to a marriage that you know is invalid for a different reason. If it's invalid, it's invalid. In the case of the same-sex marriage, it would be invalid because it's not a man and a woman. We can begin with that. And in the case of a Catholic who's getting married without the canonical form, it's invalid for that reason. Two different reasons, but they're still invalid. So I think we have to be consistent on this issue. Does all that make sense, Frank? Do you want to build on that?
No, well, that's exactly, yeah, that's consistency. It seems to be in the church, though. Like I said, to put it simply, there's a lot more to it. Simply, it says the church teaches you cannot go to that same-sex marriage, which is we know is invalid, but you can go to, you know, like you mentioned, you can go to a marriage outside the Catholic Church, you know, to keep the peace. It, right, like you said, it seems to be inconsistent.
Like it is, like, yeah.
You made that point. Mm-hmm. And just quickly, if you don't mind, just like 2 seconds,
sure.
if you could just recommend a book to give someone which would help bring, you know, their children or spouse back into the church. I have a relative whose children now seem to be, and husband seem to be agnostic. I don't know if you can recommend a book mm-hmm. that she could read that could help her to bring her family members back into the church.
So this former Catholic or fallen away Catholic is now agnostic, doesn't really know whether God exists?
Well, it's more I'd like to give it to her husband. I want to give it to a family member whose husband now and her children seem to be agnostic. So maybe this could help her or yeah. guide her into how to bring you back into the faith.
Mm-hmm. Well, for what it's worth, I wrote a book. I actually wrote 2 books that will help them to know how to go about doing this. One is called Search and Rescue, How to Bring Your Family and Friends Into or Back into the Catholic Church. And then the second Beautiful. Book is called On a Mission. Now, those, just keep in mind, Frank, those 2 books, the second one's called On a Mission, Lessons from St. Francis de Sales. That book kind of picks up where the first one leaves off. And these two are books of technique. How do you manage that process? How do you find ways to have conversations about these issues, especially with somebody who doesn't really want to talk about God or the things of God? So these books are about technique, and these are not books that you would give to those fallen away Catholics. These would be either
right.
or both of them books for the person who wants to try to help them along little by little. But you definitely don't want to give those books to the people you're trying to help along, because it's not written for them. But there are many books that would be written for them. I mean, I love Archbishop Fulton Sheen's Your Life is Worth Living. That's a classic in the genre. I love Dr. Peter Kraeff's book called The Philosophy of Jesus. He has another book similar to it called Jesus Shock, in which he lays out the case for Christ and why one should accept the evidence that Jesus is Lord, that Jesus is God. Those two are quite good. And he's a very good writer. Even though he wasn't Catholic, he did a great service with his book, Mere Christianity, and that's C.S. Lewis, another classic in the genre. I wrote a couple of books on this topic for people like this. So one that I wrote is called Why Be Catholic? 10 Answers to a Very Important Question. That's published by Doubleday. So if you wanted to see a number of possible titles that might be helpful, just go to the show page, go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. And where it says links, just click on the link for books and you'll see the book I just mentioned. Well, actually, you'll see 3 of the books that I just mentioned, and there are some other ones there as well. You can peruse through them and see if something strikes your fancy. But thankfully, there are many books of that nature. Also, I would recommend it's a talk by Father Bill Casey. It's called Lukewarm Catholicism. And he actually has 2 talks that are very powerful. One is called Lukewarm Catholicism. The other one is called The Devil, the Father of Lies. And in both of these separate talks, I think he really gets to the core of the folly of people who walk away from the church and the sacraments and Jesus, and they just sort of get into this mushy, you know, twilight zone of not really believing in anything. And it's a clarion call for them to come back to a practice of their faith. So you can search those out online. Father Bill Casey is the name of the priest. He's one of the Fathers of Mercy. Excellent preacher. I hope that helps, Frank.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You got it. Thank you. Great way to start a Monday morning. And I've got plenty ahead, including your phone calls. We'll be getting right to those after this quick timeout. If you want to call, we had a line just open. Just call 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line.
For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
I got some more good news for you. Always great on a Monday morning to get some of that. This is from Discover Magazine. There's a genetic test that could predict your heart attack risk. If you want a sneak peek at your risk of heart disease, here are your options. Your doctor can measure cholesterol and blood pressure, can ask about your history of smoking or diabetes, can look at your age and gender. For the 50-plus crowd, this approach works well, but these traditional risk factors don't account for heart attacks in those who are younger. That answer could lie in your genes. So when it comes to your health risks, genes are a major telltale. Until recently, individual genes have dominated the conversation. Breast cancer is probably the best-known example. The wrong change or variant in the BRCA1 or 2 gene could raise the risk of breast cancer up to 65% for women 70 years old. Heart disease has its own version called BRCA. Variants in any one of these specific genes can raise cholesterol dangerously high. These mutations are fairly rare. They occur in about 1 out of every 250 people. The mutations also don't explain why some men and women with normal cholesterol levels have heart attacks, particularly those in their 20s, 30s, or 40s, who would normally be considered low risk. Their experiences often start with an ambulance trip to the ER and end at the morgue. These people are really flying under the radar in our clinical practice, says Amit Khera, a co-medical director of the new Preventive Genomics Clinic at Boston's Massachusetts General Hospital. He's also the associate director of the Broad Institute's Cardiovascular Disease Initiative. So it gets into a lot of the science here, and it talks about, you know, the polygenic risk scores, single nucleotide polymorphisms, and all the kinds of terms that you had to memorize for the class that you took in anatomy and physiology. But the upshot of the whole thing is they talk in this article about a certain test that you can now take that uses these markers in genes the way they do looking for breast cancer and heart disease and other things to determine what kind of likelihood you have, especially at an early age, for coronary artery disease. And they take into account like smoking, high blood pressure, diabetes, etc. But with this new test, they can be even more accurate. And the goal, of course, is to catch these things long before they become fatal. So Cyrus will get a link to this posted for you. You can check it out. And the way to do that is go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Ed now in Burbank, California. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Patrick.
Yes.
I went to our local church yesterday morning and got there a little late. Somebody was reading or what sounded like the gospel with little additions and deletions here and there, like do this, don't do that. And everyone was sitting, and I thought, this is weird. And when that finished, everyone got up and stood, and they started singing the Alleluia to go to the gospel and all that.
Okay.
And then when the deacon got up there to do that, whoever this was preceding him, he said that, I'm going blank. He said that person did such a wonderful job talking about the gospel, he wasn't going to repeat it and just ended it. And I thought, this isn't a valid mass. What's going on here?
So let me make sure I understand it, Ed. So after what sounds like the second reading, then where the gospel would be, they did the gospel acclamation, and then the gospel would have been read. And then who was it that said what you just said? You say it was the deacon?
The deacon who would have read the gospel.
He said, I can't improve upon what you just said, so I'm not going to read the gospel?
Correct.
Huh. What was the priest doing all this time? Was he just sitting there, or did he...
Sitting there.
Didn't say anything until he started the creed after a brief
sermon.
So they
entirely omitted the gospel?
At that point, yes. I don't know if they read it as such as the second reading and for some reason, but
this was a Sunday Mass or a weekday Mass?
Yesterday morning, Sunday Mass.
Okay. Well, here's how I read that. First of all, to answer your question, no, that doesn't invalidate the Mass. That would be illicit. And if he did that intentionally, for whatever reason, I can't imagine why anybody would think to do something that strange. But it's still seriously wrong for the priest and or the deacon to do that. But that in itself would not invalidate the Mass. So the Mass, the validity of the Mass ultimately hinges upon the consecration. And so even if things might be done illicitly leading up to that point, as long as the consecration is done licitly, then the Mass is valid. So you don't have to worry about that. But it's still, I mean, if it happened as you said it did, then it's still a real problem because deacons and priests, bishops for that matter, can't just say, well, we're going to dispense with the gospel at Mass today. You know, the point of the liturgy of the word as that part of the Mass is the proclamation of the gospel. And the readings that lead up to that are preparatory for the proclamation of the gospel. That's in essence saying, well, you know, whatever Jesus might have had to say on this topic in the gospel today, we don't need to worry about that. So deeply unfortunate, Ed. And the only thing I can think of is that maybe it wasn't what you thought it was, and maybe they did read the gospel, but I don't know. I'm not trying to say you weren't paying attention, but sometimes things can go past us without us realizing it. And maybe it only appeared that way. But then again, if you're right, that's a serious problem. That's the kind of thing that, you know, hopefully somebody talked to the priest about and said, you know, why did you let him omit the gospel? You can't do that. The gospel is necessary. So maybe you could write an email and bring it up.
Okay, I did go back for the evening Mass, and everything seemed to be in order then, so perhaps someone had already done that in the meantime.
Maybe so. Maybe it was a fluke, a very unfortunate fluke. Hopefully it's not a pattern. But
well, I've never seen it before, but it sure shocked me.
Yeah, understandable. It's as I put it before, priests, deacons are not to freelance. They're not there to freelance. They're not there to celebrate anything other than what the church prescribes in the liturgical books. That's what they're there to do, primarily the priest, of course. So whenever there's a situation where the priest or the deacon is freelancing and modifying things up and making stuff up as he goes along, that's always, always a problem. Because it injures the faithful like you. Your conscience was shocked and you were unsettled by this, and it shouldn't happen. That's not the only reason, but that's sufficient reason right there. Thanks, Ed. I hope this doesn't happen again. Let's go now to Ralph in Sacramento. Good morning, Ralph.
Good morning, Patrick.
Hi.
I was looking to draw you out a little more on your argument in the use of the atomic bomb. And I'm not arguing that you're wrong. I'm just more clarification on my part. Is it that civilians were specifically targeted or in the use of the bomb that makes it immoral?
Are you asking, is my opposition predicated upon that? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. So the fact that, to take Hiroshima as an example, the fact that it was a heavily concentrated civilian population center, definitely that's a big part of the objection to it.
Okay, because I know like during the war we targeted industry, to stop the war effort, especially in Germany, and I mean they called it daylight precision bombing. It was carpet bombing. I mean they killed a lot of civilians, and they knew it.
Yeah.
Would that also be, or is that, I mean, the goal in that is to destroy the war industry, so that is a good thing to do, so that the killing of the civilians was secondary, so thus that makes it not immoral, or?
Well, there's another way to put it, but it might arrive at the same thing that you're saying, and that would be using the church's moral theology and the principle of double effect, as it's called, in which you can pursue a good goal using a good, or at least a morally neutral means. In this case, it would be the destruction of the manufacturing centers, the buildings, etc. That in itself is, I would say, morally neutral. It's not intrinsically evil to destroy a factory. Sometimes, yep. You know, you can destroy a factory in an immoral way if you're an arsonist or a competitor, or you can destroy it to make way for a newer one, or you can destroy it because it's making armaments that are killing people in war. So there can be morally licit ways of or reasons for destroying a factory like that. So this is where I would see, although there is a parallel, the divergence would be that in the case of carpet bombing those factories, the intention was to destroy the factory and put it out of commission so it couldn't create more tanks or planes or bombs. And the unintended side effect, the foreseen but unintended side effect, would be the death of civilians who lived around those buildings, or maybe workers in the buildings. They would be maybe a little less innocent than those who just happened to live in the neighborhood. But that's where I could see an application of the principle of double effect, where it's an unintended side effect, and that's not the goal. The goal wasn't to kill innocent people. The goal was to destroy the factories. So whereas I see a difference with Hiroshima as an example, because the express purpose of bombing that city was to destroy the city and everyone in it, so that the imperial government in Rome would just back off and be willing to surrender. So there, it wasn't merely, hey, we need to destroy this dock where the Navy ships are tied up, or we need to destroy this military installation. It was, let's just destroy this entire city and everyone in it. That's where it's different in that regard, because the purpose of dropping the bomb there was the utter destruction of the city itself. And that would be different, because then there is no principle of double effect there, because the intention and the means to achieving that intention were the killing of all life, including innocent human life.
Okay. Yeah, because I actually used to consider the firebombing of Tokyo to be along those same lines, because that was done to demoralize the population. Yeah. And they that actually killed more people than Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined.
Yeah, the firebombings were horrendous. Yeah, they were horrendous. And the majority of those who died, as you know, because you're a student of history, Ralph, were it was indiscriminate bombing. So it was men, women, and children, schools, homes, you name it, and people were just incinerated in a different kind of way than how they were in Hiroshima, but it was the same net effect. Yeah, so I would approach that the same way, to say if you're just indiscriminately bombing civilian population centers and the purpose of killing these people, you know, in other words, if the calculus is, yeah, let's just kill a bunch of these people. Yeah, they're innocent, but it's the only way to get the attention of the government that we're trying to get to surrender. I would say that is immoral. You can't do something evil to achieve a good goal, in other words.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for the clarification on that. So
you're welcome, Frank. It's an important topic, to be sure. So I am never unhappy when people want to revisit it. I think it's something we should really think deeply about, don't you? 888-914-9149 is the number. Hour two is about to start, so this is your opportunity to call in. 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.